From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one Michigan family's extended cruise chased from port to port by the new coronavirus.
During that time period, things just seemed to go viral, literally and figuratively.
They're on their way home, finally. Also, we're going to round up the week's news, including coverage of black voters in election 2020 and Detroit's ongoing crisis of water shutoffs.
One concern that has consistently been raised, how many people have had their water shut off over time and never got that service turned back on?
And we consider the body as an idea lab. Photographer Daryl D'Angelo Terrell talks about the alter ego featured in their lush gender-bending self-portraits.
It's a way for me to pretty much be self-reflective, for me to really think about myself and the way that I maneuver through space and through, like, the world.
All that and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, our Friday News Roundtable weighs in on the water shutoffs in Detroit and how the Democratic presidential candidates are going over among African-American voters.
Just hearing the residents say, okay, I don't feel sold. I don't feel a true connection. That's when I personally start to see that shift, that election shift toward Trump.
Plus, a missing child in Detroit raises questions about the role of media in reporting the case. But first, we start out with an ordeal at sea. The Muth family from Onsted is coming home this weekend. Steve Muth and his wife Jane, their adult daughter and her boyfriend, boarded a Holland America cruise ship February 1st. They were headed for exciting ports all along the Pacific Rim. But since then, the ship has gone from port to port, denied entry in several countries because of the new coronavirus outbreak. We caught up with Steve Muth from the ship, which is now docked in Cambodia. Steve Muth, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to say where you are, where the ship is right now?
Yeah, so we're in a location, actually a port location in Cambodia called Shankville. It's a fairly industrial-type port. There's all kinds of cranes and construction equipment around, but it's a lesser-known location compared to Phnom Penh or other places that people might be familiar with. But we're sitting actually on the boat right now, getting ready to get rested to, I believe, depart tomorrow.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
Just to recap, your family's been stuck on this ship for weeks now, and no one on the ship had the virus, correct?
That's exactly right. So this cruise started actually on February 1st. We left, I believe, from DTW on January 28th, I believe it was, 28th or 29th. Got into Hong Kong. The flight was late, so not a problem. Our cruise left the next day. Upon arriving in Hong Kong, we donned our masks, you know, surgical-type masks, as many people do. We bought them at the Lowe's, actually, before we left. So we were covered and did a little bit of sightseeing, I'm going to say maybe 6 hours or so before we got on the boat and started to enjoy the cruise. And so, you know, everything seemed to go fine on the front end. One variable, however, was that they changed the disembarkation point at the end. So instead of finishing in Shanghai, we were going to finish up in Tokyo,
right?
Which was okay. It was an expense, but I would have rather gone to Shanghai. They did that out of concern for the virus.
Right.
So during that time period, things just seemed to go viral, literally and figuratively. There were a lot of people getting sick, some people dying, and I think concern went on through the roof. It got to a point, in my view, it got to a point of hysteria.
Yeah.
And so we started with our very first port basically being taken from us. Manila in the Philippines, they had one death. I think an individual, a bus driver who was from China, had died. And before you know it, the president himself called out and said, that cruise ship will not stop here. So we had a feeling that there might be some trouble from that point forward. And sure enough, the next port of call we got into in Taiwan, they said we could stay an extra day there. And that was rescinded. So we got one port of call in Taiwan, and then they said, no, you can't come back here anymore either. And so then they said, well, we'll reconfigure the whole cruise, and we'll do about, you know, two or three extra stops in Japan. So we started making our way to Japan, when all of a sudden the President Abe came out and said, no, you won't.
No dice.
You're not coming to Japan.
I was just going to ask, I mean, as the situation was unfolding, did conditions on the ship change very much?
They really didn't. You know, this ship has been absolutely outstanding in terms of its level of service. The food's been great. The people have been great all the way around. I really have had no complaints. I don't think anybody else realistically could. I say that. I've heard some bloggers or other types of people try and express some complaints, but it's silly. This is a cruise ship. You could wander around upstairs, go to the tiki bar, you know, the Lido deck. You'll see people hanging out, drinking wine and sucking on margaritas. So it's, you know, it's actually, the service here has been exceptional. There's no question about it. So pretty laid back from that standpoint.
Sign me up.
Yeah, really, exactly. This is not a refugee boat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This isn't a fishing boat. It's, you know, a little disconcerting because you don't get your ports of call. But other than that, you know, I'm fairly laid back traveler. I've been doing it since I was, 1920. I went to Michigan State and I did my last year abroad. So by the time that was done, I'd already been through 25 or so countries. I'm a seasoned traveler, so these kinds of changes don't bother me. My wife, my daughter, her boyfriend, a little bit more, I think, busted up about it. They were really hoping to see some of those ports. Now, the good thing is we'll get to do that later anyway, because we get a free cruise out of this, plus our refund on this.
Wow. And here I was thinking that you guys would have run through all your vacation books and played all the shuffleboard you could handle, and those cabin walls would be closing in, but it sounds like that was not the case. Well, do you mind saying what field you work in?
Actually, I'm a human resources consultant. I've got some 30 years of experience. I do seminars as well as consulting work. In fact, I'll be doing one for the Chamber of Commerce when I get back in a week or so for the Michigan Chamber. That's a concern of mine, or was, that I was going to be in quarantine or something was going to prevent me from being able to present to the group. Once we get back, I'm going to request that we, at least certainly myself, my wife's a nurse, she'll request as well, that we get an official coronavirus test just to make sure there's no issues. I want to make sure that there's absolutely no problem with us being out in public.
I was trying to imagine what it would be like calling in to a boss every day saying, yeah, we're still out here. It sounds like maybe that might be something your wife would have to do, but you're able to set your own schedule a little bit more.
You're absolutely right. And so the challenge is here is that this is unprecedented, at least as far as I know of it, but I've never seen a cruise basically be turned away for illness, or let me say this, a belief that there might be an illness on board. There's not even an illness on board. Now, you may have heard, you know, there have been other instances where viruses run rampant through a cruise. They shut it down early, what have you. But this is unique. So what will happen is, I think, is that when we go through that CDC test, we'll get some kind of written result. And when we do, she'll be able to present that. And that's got to be good enough, right? I mean, I don't know what else they could ask for. So I think that should be enough.
We hear your family's headed home soon?
Yeah, in fact, as you're on the phone with me here, the cabin steward banged on the door and gave my wife paperwork, which means I'm probably going to have to get up at 5 in the morning and end this journey a little bit earlier than I wanted to. But that's fine. I know my daughter and her boyfriend got their notice about 3 hours ago and were a little bit concerned because, you know, they're not as well traveled as we are. And there's literally, they've got us going all around the globe. If I'm not mistaken, we have a stopover in Paris at Charles de Gaulle. So,
wow.
I know we're going to circumnavigate the globe by the time this thing is done. That's kind of weird.
I hate to break this to you, but it's gotten really cold while you were gone.
I know.
You sure you want to come back?
I was telling the family, actually, is we're on the beach, right? Our first day off the boat in probably 10 days. And here we are. We're at the beautiful seaside beach. And I told them, I said, look, I happened to check Onsted. I want to say it was 14 degrees when I checked. I think it's even colder since. So I said, you know, don't get used to this or, you know, think about coming back because it's going to be a different world when we get back to Michigan. Let's face it, though, it's been fairly mild most of the winter, right? Up until recently, anyway.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Steve, I don't mean to make light of this situation because the public health emergency throughout Asia is very real, but I couldn't help but wonder if your family is thinking ahead to next year's vacation.
There's no doubt, you know, hey, we get a free cruise out of this, so we're certainly going to take advantage of that. You know, this is obviously a very exceptional situation. You know, my perspective has changed in terms of, you know, from a health perspective, as you mentioned, the seriousness of it is what should be the protocol moving forward. I've got some real concerns with, if you think about this, countries, Japan is an example, an ally of ours, basically saying we're not going to let you come off the boat because you may have sick people or what have you. And what really irritated me was Guam, of all things, in American territory, also saying that we couldn't come onto the island to essentially just move on and catch flights to get to our home locations. That, to me, doesn't seem acceptable. In fact, it seems quintessentially un-American to say, no, you can't come here because we're worried you might mess with our health system or what have you. By the way, cruise ship people, for the most part, aren't real poor people. We have insurance, most of us, not looking to take advantage of local health facilities without paying for it.
Right.
You know, I struggle with that. And I think, to be honest, that the government needs to address just what this means and how we can move moving forward. Let me tell you, if we tried to tell the people of Guam, you can't come to Michigan or somewhere anywhere else in the mainland of the U.S., that'd be crazy, I would think, because yeah. If you're born in Guam, you're a U.S. citizen. So I don't know. I really struggle with that, and I'm not sure what anybody can do about it, but I think we have a couple of senators and some people in the House of Representatives look at making some changes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking a couple minutes to talk to us, and we wish your family a safe journey home.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, April. I hope all goes well. I hope it gets warmer there before we get back.
Your lips to God's ears.
It's not going to happen. Okay. I know. I'll freeze. That's all right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, April. Have a great day.
You too. Steve Muth of Onsted coming to us from the cruise ship in Cambodia, the ship that he and his family have been stranded on for several weeks. They're expected home this weekend. Just a reminder, for Black History Month, the host of Same Same Different, Bryce Huffman, is hosting 3 live events all around the state. If you haven't heard it yet, it's a Michigan radio podcast that explores identity and how to survive otherness with our full humanity and sanity intact. Bryce and his guests will be talking about how Black history is and is not taught in our schools. The first event is Wednesday, February 19th at 7 p.m. at Hopcat in East Lansing. If you need more info, you'll find what you're looking for at michiganradio.org. After we come back, we speak with photographer Daryl D'Angelo Terrell, who never really had the option of being a person who was going to blend in. Their work reflects a search for community in all its forms.
I'm having conversations about this intersectionality of what it means to be Black and queer. I'm having conversations about what it means to be a Black male-bodied person who is feminine, who exists within his feminine energy.
That story's coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. All of us have some version of ourselves who lives in our head, your favorite self, your strongest self, the self that this world, for whatever reason, doesn't want to let you be. For queer and gender non-binary artists, that self is not just a daydream. It's someone who might get you through years of being made to feel like an outsider. It can also be a canvas for really important ideas. Detroit photographer and curator Daryl D'Angelo Terrell has been exploring identity, image, and history through their work. Terrell, a 2019 Kresge Fellow who identifies as queer and femme, has been working on a particularly interesting photo series featuring a face that they don't always show to the world. We started out talking about how Terrell first got into self-portraiture while an undergrad at Wayne State.
So I was originally just making frivolous work just to get the assignments out of the way. And I had a professor who was like, you should really focus on building a body of work. You're talented, but you're just being lazy. And at first I was like, okay, let me see if I can take photos of other people. But then that became a problem because people's schedules or people would flake. So one day I was just like, you know what? Forget it. I'm going to take photos of myself. honestly, it came me doing self-portraiture came out of needing a subject, and then of course studying other photographers who do predominantly self-portraiture really opened my eyes on how important and how powerful self-portraiture could be.
You've been working on a photo series of self-portraits, but they're portraits of a very specific side of you. Mm-hmm. an alter ego named Dion.
Mm-hmm.
Would you introduce us?
Oh, okay. Dion is a fat Black femme queer non-binary identifying individual. Dion extends from my love and my admiration for all of the Black femmes I grew up around on the east side of Detroit. So I pull influence from a lot of them, but also a lot of my friends who are in my close circle, but then also from poetry and music and television and movies.
What do you feel Dion represents that you weren't expressing in other ways?
Oh, I mean, so I feel like a lot of my work, specifically when it's self-portrait, it's a way for me to pretty much be self-reflective, for me to really think about myself and the way that I maneuver through space and through, like, the world. And being that, okay, I am 6'7", 360 pounds. I am big. I, in this body, have had insecurities, right? Feelings that I'm not worthy of, to be desired, not feelings that I'm not worthy of love. Like, I'll be 29 this year and I've never been in a relationship, but I have friends who, like, are married with children and own homes, and I'm, all of these things were always in the back of my head. So I started thinking about how I can pretty much present or formulate a false identity or an alter ego that exhibited everything that I feel like I lack. Mm-hmm. And by doing so came Dion, and Dion became this extremely high femme person because, again, I admire the girls from my hood, like the girls in the late 90s, early 2000s who have, like, the extremely long fingernails with the airbrush designs and the rhinestones on it. The girls who would go to the beauty supply to buy colored contacts. The girls who would buy all of this costume jewelry and cover their neck in it when I was in high school.
These photographs do not represent drag in a traditional sense, but Dion is confident and Dion is very glamorous. Mm-hmm. And these photos seem to be influenced by a whole range of images.
Yeah.
From Robert Mapplethorpe's more austere self-portraits, mm-hmm, to the black velvet pop art images of black women that you've talked about seeing when you were a younger person.
Yeah.
Could you just talk about on an art direction level how you think through her looks in these photos?
Oh, definitely. So the first three diptychs are titled Untitled Dion Number 1, 2, and 3, or Sitting Pretty, or These Men Revolve Around Me. In this image, I found it to be important to purchase a peacock wicker chair. So, like, growing up, my mom, my auntie, other elders in my family, people in my community, they always had these photos of themselves and these peacock wicker chairs.
It's a staple.
It's a staple, definitely. And then, like, growing up and becoming really interested in just, like, black history and finding out who Huey P. Newton was, and seeing this photo of him in the peacock wicker chair with the spear and the shield, right? And then back to the black velvet pop art paintings that I used to see at my Auntie Wanda's house of, like, this black woman sitting at a throne with two leopards at her feet. I think about that peacock wicker chair as, like, the African-American throne. It's like it's our way of honoring ourselves as king and queens, as royalty, as putting, like, it's a way for us to honor and cherish ourselves in ways that no one else outside of our race will and does.
I don't know if it's a case of the materials or, mm-hmm, just the posture. I mean, it's kind of impossible to slump in a peacock wicker chair.
Yeah, because you'll fall over.
Yeah, right?
I've done it.
It just lends this sort of regal attitude to the whole picture.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Just to switch gears a little bit, mm-hmm, could you tell us a little bit about where you work and how you work these days? Part of the reason I ask is, mm-hmm, that you received a Kresge Arts Fellowship,
yes,
last year.
Yes, true.
It's $25,000, and that is a big grant for a working artist.
Yeah, especially someone early in their career.
Yeah, but at the same time, when we think about $25,000 in terms of, like, you know, a salary, mm-hmm, it's not that much.
True, true.
So I just kind of wondered what it's like to try to put together the practical aspects,
yeah,
well, of your practice.
Thankfully, receiving the Kresge, I, like, purchased a lot of equipment. I commissioned a lot of people to help me with some photos that I have not yet, like, made public yet. So, like, I've gotten wigs customly made. I've had makeup artists actually do my makeup. I've purchased, like, new lenses, backdrops, things of that nature.
You mentioned that back when you were growing up, you weren't really making the scene in terms of nightlife.
Mm-mm. I felt uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, who's your community within Detroit right now?
That's interesting because I've been asking myself this question. So I feel like I have, like, I have like my friends, my close-knit friends, in which there are about 6 or 7 of them who I can go to and vent to and talk to and cry to and have conversations about art with. But then as far as like a wider community, I don't know. it's something I'm trying to restructure. But I do feel like I'm growing a community. I honestly just can't identify who they are.
Detroit's art scene feels so charged up. Mm-hmm. But would you say it still can be a challenging place for queer artists to find each other and to find work?
I won't say it's hard for us to find each other because once you find one, it pretty much becomes word of mouth and we do like talk about each other. So I guess that would be part of my community. yeah, so like there are a handful of amazing queer artists here in the city who I love to hang out with, and we talk about art and theory. So there's one painter, and her name is Aijana. Me and her went to a bar and talked about Fran Moten's book, Black and Blur, and pretty much how it's difficult to understand and how he talks in circles using these huge words that are inaccessible to people who don't have a PhD in art, right?
Which is most of us.
Hello, I don't even have my PhD in art. I don't think I want it. But as far as like finding other queer artists in Detroit, we have that. Now, as far as showing in Detroit as a queer artist, it works and then it doesn't work, right? So because my work currently with working with Dion, it is very visibly queer. I'm being tapped for all of the Pride exhibitions right now, which is bittersweet because I'm like, okay, so between January and June, I don't really have anything planned. And then June hits and I have 4 exhibitions in 1 month. And I'm looking like, and all of them want the same work. And it's just like, okay, this is great. I'm happy that you're interested in my work. But I don't want to be that person who's only tapped locally when it comes to Pride events. Like, the work that I'm having is having a much wider conversation than just, like, here's gay work. Like, right. I'm having conversations about this intersectionality of what it means to be Black and queer. I'm having conversations about what it means to be a Black male-bodied person who is feminine and who exists within his feminine energy. I want to be seen for more than just, like, oh, the go-to gay artist for Pride Month. But outside of that, yeah, I mean, people, a lot of DIY spots I work through. If not showing art, I will, like, do a DJ set, or I would be the MC, or things of that nature. So there are ways for me to be present in Detroit.
Among the many, many things that you do, you started an Instagram account called the Museum of Contemporary Art IG.
Yes, Mocha IG.
And you use it to show work by people who are part of the African and Latinx diaspora.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a riff on Mocha as a museum of contemporary art only existing in the Instagram world.
Right, right.
It's so sad that this is an Instagram account and not a brick-and-mortar museum
yet. You know, we're going to speak this into existence.
Yes. Could you talk a little bit about how you curate that feed?
Yeah, definitely. So I went to grad school not only to become an artist, but to curate. This is something I've always been interested in. My mom, when I was in, I think I was in 10th grade, my mom took me to the DIA after they had finished remodeling. And this is when I first seen Glenn Ligon's To Disembark, which is this freight box in the African-American art, contemporary art space of the DIA. And it's a wooden freight box that plays Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. And this box is pretty much talking about Henry Box Brown, which was a slave who put himself in the freight box and shipped himself to freedom. And I remember my first time going into this specific gallery space in the museum, and it's that piece is in a corner. It's next to Alison Saar's Blood, Sweat, and Tears and a Betty Saar piece. And then across from it were like these two beautiful photos from James Van Der Zee. And then away from it was a painting by Robert Colescott. And I'm sitting in this space, and I'm like, what is going on? I was like, wow. Like, I think that was my first time having a strong emotional response to art. Like, actually sitting there and like tearing up, my mom is like sitting there talking to the security guard, and the security guard is talking to my mom about like things in the space. And then like, I'm listening to them, but at the same time, I'm like really engulfed by Glenn Ligon's To Disembark. Mainly because like, as a younger kid, I loved Billie Holiday. But seeing this piece and reading the literature that the museum had in front of it was really just like really effective for me. So in the back of my head, I always knew I wanted to curate. After graduating, I started applying for curatorial residencies and fellowships and jobs. And a lot of the times, the response was always, you don't have enough experience. Mm-hmm. So in the ages and days of social media, the best way to make experience is to make your own experience. So that's why I formed Mocha IG. Also because with my experience of like applying to a lot of these residencies, I was applying to like curatorial photography jobs when a lot of times they were using photography as just like a documentation of yesteryear and not using photography as an art form, which is stressing me out. Mm-hmm. So I was okay, I really want to be able to like formulate how contemporary African-American art and contemporary Latinx art is being produced at such a beautiful and high quality, and how this work needs to be seen.
It's very funny to me that everyone thought that Instagram would make a photographer out of all of us.
No.
But I that is clearly, if you look at Instagram for 5 minutes, you can tell that that's not necessarily true.
Not at
but
all.
It's definitely made a curator out of everyone.
Oh, definitely. Because we're thinking about how we're perceived. It's like we are carefully thinking about how everything is shown on social media.
Yes. Well, Daryl D'Angelo Terrell, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Daryl D'Angelo Terrell. Keep an eye open for their work around Detroit this year. They're an artist in residence at Red Bull Arts Detroit. If you can't wait for that, and maybe you shouldn't, you can find them on Instagram. And don't miss the feed they're curating at mocha.ig, too. It's never too early for happy hour here on Stateside. Lester Graham sent us this audio postcard from his occasional series, Cheers, Exploring Michigan's Cocktail Culture. This one comes from Buffalo Trader's Lounge in Grand Rapids.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we are in Grand Rapids checking out the bar scene here. Where are we today?
We are at Buffalo Trader's Lounge, which I have to say is this gorgeous space, kind of mid-century modern decor, and I love it.
And we've got Tony Jones here with us, the bar lead at the bar. You are mixing up a drink for us. It looks really interesting. What's it called?
This is the Two Horse Town. It's kind of a aquavit and tropical spiced sour.
And why'd you choose this one?
I like this drink because it showcases two of our local distillers, Long Road Distillery and Eastern Kill Distillery, formerly known as Grey Skies.
We were at Eastern Kill, and Brandon was talking about how as soon as you have two distilleries in a town, people want to pit them against each other. Oh, do you like theirs better? And so he loved the fact that the bartenders in town are like, no, we're going to mix and match.
Tell me how you make this.
Okay, so this is 1 ounce of Long Road Aquavit, 3/4 ounce of Eastern Kill's Bartender's Blend Rum, 3/4 ounce Falernum, 3/4 ounce lime, and just a little bit of sugar.
That sounds a little bit like a tiki drink.
It has some roots. I was kind of inspired by tiki recipes with this one. Just wanted to take it in a little bit different direction than I'd had before.
I don't think we saw the bartender's spiced rum when we were at Eastern Kill. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is a rum that they released a couple years ago under the Grey Skies name. It was kind of a one-time release, so their bottles do exist, but it's not something they principally sell. It is a white rum that they have infused with a selection of spices that was specifically picked out by some Grand Rapids bartenders. It has like a nice heavy caraway note up front, which is why it fits into this drink so well with the aquavit. They kind of complement each other, especially with the falernum to kind of bridge the gap. This drink is prepared in a shaking tin with an egg white as well. Gives it a nice frothiness. Combine all ingredients in a tin and give a heavy shake with a couple of big cubes and then double strain.
So I know that Buffalo Traders is a sister bar to Sidebar. And last time we were in Grand Rapids, we loved Sidebar. And one of the things that we talked about was Duncan had this really interesting shake. And you too had a really interesting shake. It was fun to watch you. It's one of my favorite things when I come to a bar is to see how people move.
Yeah, what's your method?
I don't know. I guess I depends on the drink. Some drinks need a nice, real hard shake, so you'll want to use both hands, and other times you can get away with a single hand shake.
Yeah, you have a distinctive style, and it seems like it's the fingerprint of every bartender, so it's all yours.
I guess so. I don't really put too much thought into it.
All right, we're going to take a taste of this. It's very nice, very balanced. It does remind me of a tiki drink a little bit.
So what I think is really interesting about this drink is I got Akavit very much up front. I was like, oh, yeah, this is an Akavit drink. And then as I sat with it, it really evolved on the palate. So it's got a lot going on. Those spice notes come in and the lime. I really like this.
What do your customers tell you when they taste it for the first time?
First of all, thank you. I think it's kind of a mixed bag reaction. Most people seem to enjoy it. The egg white can be off-putting for some drinkers for sure. We usually get positive responses. It's made two menu changes. It's stayed on kind of as a personal favorite, honestly.
It's Two Horse Down at Buffalo Trader. Cheers.
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 After a break, we're checking in on the week's headlines with our Friday roundtable. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Just as winter's temperatures are getting really serious, we've noticed that a few of the issues we've been following for some time are deepening. With us to go over some of the week's big stories are Kat Stafford, a reporter for the Detroit Free Press, an Ida B. Wells Fellow, and a native of the city of Detroit. Kat, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
And Candace Fortin is with us too, Chief of Engagement and Operations for Outlier Media. Hello, Candace.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Let's start out with a measure that Detroit City Council is working on, drafting a letter to ask Governor Gretchen Whitmer to declare a public health emergency around water shutoffs. Now, that's not the only ask that council is making. They're also trying to see if they can just get the Water Bureau to stop. So I just wanted to ask you two, which is more meaningful, that letter asking the governor to make a big, bold letter declaration about this, or the separate resolution asking Detroit Water and Sewer to just stop doing shutoffs for the foreseeable future? Candace, you got thoughts?
Yeah, well, if you think about community impact, certainly that second one is going to be more important for Detroiters. So if you have an immediate stop to shutoffs, that's going to really mean something for folks who are facing that crisis every day in their household. So I would say if we're thinking about community impact, really thinking about stopping shutoffs is an important thing to talk about.
Kat, I was wondering, which do you think is likely to instigate change?
I agree with Candace. You know, for several years, we have really seen a momentum among Detroiters, water advocates, to really push the city to implement some sort of moratorium on these shutoffs. So to see an actual resolution or effort coming forward through city council, I think would have more of an immediate impact. I mean, this dates back to the height of the water shutoff crisis when you had international calls for the city to stop these water shutoffs. So I'm seeing across, especially social media, a lot of advocates on the ground, grassroots activists who are really applauding, particularly Sheffield, for taking a step forward. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out because the city so far has kind of pushed back on this notion of halting the shutoffs.
I was looking at the numbers. In 2014, 33,000 households lost water. I think the more recent numbers would suggest the city's got it down to several thousand. Does that sound about right to you, too?
So I think last year the city shut off about 23,000 residential accounts. So that's down 10,000 from 2014, which, I mean, over time is not really a substantial decrease in the number of shutoffs.
One concern that has consistently been raised by a lot of people who work or interface with these families dealing with this issue is how many people have had their water shut off over time and never got that service turned back on. And when you go to the water department to seek this data, this information, to be blunt, it's very hard to get a hard number, to get hard data to support one way or the other that, yes, people are getting their services turned back on, or no, you have some people that haven't had water for years. I have one source of mine who he works directly in this community, and he is providing water to residents across the city who have not had water for several years. So it's a serious problem, and I would love to see more data, more information coming from the city's water department to address this concern about some people who may be potentially living without water for quite some time.
You know, it's just thinking about what it would mean to find alternative means for washing your clothes and cooking and even just flushing the toilet. I mean, the city's public health officer told the Detroit News that the city's found no association between a shutoff and, you know, communicable diseases. But I've got to wonder what that does to people's mental health.
Absolutely. I remember a really great reporting last year from Martina Guzman in The Guardian, where she followed a mother who was pregnant, who had lost water and was having to carry, you know, cases of water to her home to wash her children, to prepare food, and the toll that took on her body and her health during their pregnancy. I mean, you know, we might not be able to find the statistics to back up a correlation, but certainly in narrative, we know that there's a correlation and real serious health risk for especially vulnerable communities like children and senior citizens.
So the advocates have been asking for this moratorium for years now. Do you think council's voice is really going to break through and make much of a difference?
That's a great question.
That was a long silence there.
We'll see. You know, I mean, this is such a delicate issue, an issue that Detroiters are very passionate about. And I'm sure people are hopeful. They are hopeful that this time this will actually, you know, put fire under officials to help people deal with this. But at the same time, there's been a breakdown in trust. You know, this has been going on for so long that people are saying, okay, this is just another item being proposed, but will there actually be systemic change here? So I think that there needs to be some rebuilding of trust, but I think some folks are cautiously optimistic.
If you're just joining us, my guests for the weekly news roundtable are Kat Stafford of the Detroit Free Press and Candace Fortman from Outlier Media. Kat Stafford, I believe you have some news for us.
Yes, I have accepted a new role with the Associated Press, where I will be covering race and ethnicity. And for the remainder of this year, I'll heavily be focused on the 2020 election. Very excited.
Congratulations. That's awesome. But here was my question. Are you staying in Detroit?
Yes. And for me, that's the best part of this role, because there's so much happening in the city, the good, the bad, the in-between. And I'm excited that I get to take the expertise that I've been able to build at the Detroit Free Press and take it to this level. And I've told people time and time again, I feel that Detroit is literally a microcosm of a lot of the issues that are facing communities across the country. Poverty, even water shutoffs, mm-hmm. foreclosures, mm-hmm. you name it. Everything that's happening here is literally happening elsewhere. So I'm excited to hit the ground running in this new role.
Yeah, I was hearing some reporting out of Iowa around the time of the caucus about caucus voters feeling deeply, deeply conflicted about what would voters in the swing states want me to do? Who would they want me to go for? And I just wondered how many of them were aware of low turnout among African-American voters in Michigan. Can you just reset the history of what happened in 2016?
So in 2016, I was actually one of the reporters at the Free Press who was kind of on the ground in the community just trying to get a pulse of what was happening. And I just recall just looking at when President Obama ran and comparing that to when Hillary Clinton ran, it was a very noticeable difference. I was at a church in Flint when she came to speak, and just hearing the residents say, okay, I don't feel sold. I don't feel a true connection. That's when I personally started to see that shift, that election shift toward Trump. And I think when you look toward 2020, I think people once again are feeling a little scattered. They want to feel connected to a candidate. And a lot of the voters that I've spoken with, they're struggling to find that connection. And I think moving forward, if the Democrats want to win this key base of voters, they're going to have to speak to those issues that impact Black communities. It's more than criminal justice. People want to hear about health. They want to hear about jobs. They want to hear much more than they feel what's being given to them. So I think moving forward, Detroit is going to be huge for the state of Michigan. And once again, that's why I'm so excited to be here to really tell those rich stories.
You know, white journalists often talk about the black vote as if it were monolithic in favor of one candidate. Is that your observation?
You know, I hear that a lot, and I think the media overall has to do a much better job. And that's correct. You know, all black voters are not behind one specific candidate. Even when you look at generations, there's generational differences within the black community. Some black voters are more conservative. Some are far more progressive. They're not throwing their support behind one specific person. And I think that media coverage really needs to get into that nuance, even beyond black voters, whether it's Latino voters, whether it's, you know, whomever the demographic is. You really need to dive deeper into understanding the issues that are important to these communities.
You know, Politico published a story this week suggesting that major black donors to the Democratic Party feel that the candidates are not doing very much to check in right now. Candace, have I seen this movie somewhere?
I think that we have seen it many times. And it's a really unfortunate thing that is happening in the Democratic Party. There is sort of this idea that black voters will just support Democratic candidates. And so we don't need to do the outreach. We don't need to do the real on the ground work. And I really do think it is deeply impacting voter turnout. When you looked at the Obama machine, the thing about that machine was that it was constantly churning inside of communities. So whether it was Obama himself on the ground or that incredible reach that he had where he could get almost anybody to go out and campaign for him in cities like Detroit and Baltimore and Oakland and D.C., these very black cities. We do not see candidates doing that at that same rate. And it likely is making that voter base feel like they are not a part of the conversation. And if you aren't a part of the conversation, why would you show up to the table to vote?
If you're just joining us, my guests are Candace Fortman of Outlier Media and Kat Stafford of the Detroit Free Press. There's one more story I wanted to ask you both about. There's a teenage boy named Caleb McIntosh who's been missing from his home in Detroit since January 30th. And Caleb left Cass Tech High School in the middle of the day, and he never returned home. Candace, I understand you've been in contact with the family trying to help his mother get the word out. What do we know at this point?
Sadly, we don't know anything more than that, and that is the truly frightening part. He reached out to his mother later that night on January 30th after he left school. Said he was fine, and no one has seen or heard from him since. There have been lots of people hitting the streets, the neighborhoods near Cass Tech, neighborhoods near where his friends live. The students at Cass Tech have been questioned. Teachers, counselors have all been talked to, and no one seems to know anything. You know, we're at February 14th. He's been missing since January 30th. And so the intensity and need to really make sure that we are turning over every rock to help find this young man increases every day that he does not come home or does not return phone calls to his family.
Caleb's mother said on social media that he'd been struggling in recent months emotionally and behaviorally. Kat, do you feel like the city or the state or the public school system have any kind of meaningful structure in place to tackle the unique mental health challenges and societal struggles that black teenagers and brown teenagers are going through every day?
That's a great question. You know, a couple years ago, the Free Press did a pretty huge project that looked at a lot of the issues that face children growing up in the city. And one of the stories that I did, I talked directly to children and teenagers that just so happened to be some Cass Tech kids, and they felt that a lot of the issues that they face kind of just get swept under the rug, or they're not at the forefront. When we talk about crime in the city, it's just that single instance, but you never talk to the children who might be impacted or who might see some things that aren't typical in other parts of the country. So I think a lot of people would like to see much, much more resources devoted to the mental health of our children, devoted to helping them sort through a lot of the things that you see when you grow up in a city that faces a lot of troubles and struggles, such as the city of Detroit. So I think you also have, on the same hand, a lot of teachers who, you know, they're not trained therapists or physicians, but they are put into these classrooms with these children who have some issues, and they try their hardest with the resources that they have to help these children. But once again, we need more resources for our kids.
There's been a lot of talk in recent years about failures in the media to report on missing black children. as often and as completely as white children, and police failure to respond as quickly. Do either of you sense a change in the dynamic, or do you feel like we're still light years away from where we need to be?
Yeah, no, I think that we're still really far from where we need to be when we think about the intensity of when a child is missing and that child is a person of color, specifically a black or brown child, compared to, I think about this all the time, if Caleb had been a 16-year-old white girl from Bloomfield, the intensity of coverage, I know, I don't have to question it, I know it would have been different. And I don't know how, at this point, we can illustrate any further the value of black and brown bodies, right, to the media, to police departments. And what happens then is that the community takes on the burden of getting the word out and doing the work that media organizations, that the police department should have been doing. I can't believe that DPD just put a media alert out this week. He's been missing since January 30th. There is just no, in my brain, no logical explanation for why it has taken so long for there to be attention given to this story in mass. This is one of our own children. This is a child of our city. And if we aren't protecting our own children, then shame on us. This is a story that should be told. And it doesn't matter what the body looks like. This is a child that's missing. And I can't wrap my brain around the lack of attention given to this story.
And for me, what this also really speaks to is that lack of diversity, that lack of inclusion, the lack of having enough black journalists and other people of color in the newsrooms who not only report the news, but who make the decisions about what's actually being covered. And so when your newsroom does not have enough of those voices who are tapped in, like Candace's, to the community, you suffer. Your coverage suffers, and who suffers because of that? The community. And what does that do? It sows more distrust, not distrust in, you know, the law enforcement, but the media as well. And so that's a huge issue. And I think that's part of the problem that you see here.
Yeah.
Kat Stafford with the Detroit Free Press. She is a short timer on her beat. She's moving over to the Associated Press for what I'm sure will be a wild election year. And Candace Fortman has been with us, too, from Outlier Media. I just wanted to thank you both today. I guess we're going to call this the Galentine's Day edition of the Weekly Roundup.
What a great way to celebrate.
Yes.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
He's looking at you, kid.
Jenny and me was like peas and carrots.
And wild, true wild, will follow you forever.
L is for the way you look at me.
I think we can all agree that nothing says Valentine's Day and I love you like quality food and drink. Some Michigan chefs and brewers have been preparing things that might fit into the less conventional Valentine's menu. How about a nice big hoppy IPA? Bell's Brewery has a special edition brew on sale for a very limited time. If you're in Kalamazoo, you can get a variation on their very popular two-hearted ale today. It is called Black-Hearted Ale. Bell's reminds us that love is not always handwritten notes and candy hearts. Sometimes it is a sinkhole full of skeletons and worn-out platitudes. If you're looking for something that eats more like a meal, Primanti Brothers is running a promotion in its Taylor location in Southwest Michigan today. Bring a photo of that no longer special someone. Primanti Brothers will shred it for you and give you in return a coupon for half off a sandwich. I gotta say, that sounds very satisfying. But folks, on this most performative of Hallmark holidays, please remember, you don't have to spend a mint. Give your squeeze what she really wants. A throne forged from the bones of her enemies and a relentless reign of terror over the masses. Did I just say that out loud? That's it for today's episode. Thanks for listening and happy Valentine's Day. You know you're always our number one. I'm April Baer. We'll catch up with you next week.
Is even more than anyone that you adore can love, is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two in love can't make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love. was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you.